The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The Supreme Court hears the most important abortion case in decades.
Roe and Casey's core holding, according to those courts, is that the people can protect an unborn girl's life when she just barely can survive outside the womb, but not any earlier when she needs a little more help. That is the world under Roe and Casey.
Omicron causes a panic.
There's a state of emergency in New York based on a virus that has not reached New York and which is described by the discoverer of the virus as mild.
And why we should not hold the Olympics in Beijing.
We will be giving a propaganda victory to a genocidal communist regime.
Catch my program each weekday morning, please, live 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. You can also watch now on the Salem News Channel app. Download it. Please follow me as well on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt and follow this program at Town Hall Review. On Wednesday of this week, the Supreme Court heard the most important arguments in the field of abortion since those made in the Roe v. Wade case of 1973 and the Planned Parenthood v. Casey case of 1992. They heard a direct challenge from the state of Mississippi in the case of Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization to those two decisions and the federalization of abortion law. They heard from the Solicitor General of Mississippi that, in fact, the abortion laws of the United States have been wholly made up by the court, which is being addressed. And the Solicitor General of Mississippi said, turn over those cases. Reverse Roe. Reverse Casey. And get out of this terrible jam into which the court has slowly walked over 50 years. On the morning after the arguments, I played a great deal of what the justices themselves had to say so that you could get a sense of why so many of us who observe the court closely have concluded that the time for Roe and Casey's demise is close at hand. The Solicitor General of Mississippi stood before the court and did a very difficult thing. He argued that the court has been wrong for 50 years and needs to overturn its work. Now, Scott Stewart is a pretty smart guy, and he's a very serious lawyer. Began his argument this way, asking the court to overturn Roe and Casey.
It didn't matter that the law applies when an unborn child is undeniably human, when risks to women surge, and when the common abortion procedure is brutal. The lower courts held that because the law prohibits abortions before viability, it is unconstitutional no matter what. Roe and Casey's core holding, according to those courts, is that the people can protect an unborn girl's life when she just barely can survive outside the womb, but not any earlier when she needs a little more help. That is the world under Roe and Casey. That is not the world the Constitution promises. The Constitution places its trust in the people. On hard issue after hard issue, the people make this country work. Abortion is a hard issue. It demands the best from all of us, not a judgment by just a few of us. When an issue affects everyone, and when the Constitution does not take sides on it, it belongs to the people. Roe and Casey have failed, but the people, if given the chance, will succeed. This court should overrule Roe and Casey and uphold the state's law. I welcome the court's questions.
And the court began those questions. Chief Justice Roberts asked about the 15-week ban. Chief Justice.
I'd like to focus on the 15-week ban because that's not a dramatic departure from viability. It is the standard that the vast majority of other countries have. When you get to the viability standard, we share that standard with the People's Republic of China and North Korea.
He's right. There's no getting around it. There's a whole case law of abortion that doesn't make any sense, except for these two terrible cases of Roe and Casey. And those are going away. Why? Because the right to abortion is not in the Constitution, as Justice Thomas framed in his question. I'll just play the question part and then end it.
General, would you specifically tell me, state what the right is? Is it specifically abortion? Is it liberty? Is it autonomy? Is it privacy?
It's none of those. It doesn't exist. That's what he's getting at. Justice Alito, at this point, also comes in and talks about the fact that people just know this is made up. Cut number 27.
You do emphasize that the court drew the line at viability in Roe and reaffirmed that in Casey. And that is certainly something that we have to take very seriously into consideration. But suppose we were considering that question now for the first time. I'm sure you know the arguments about the viability line as well as I do, probably better than I do. What would you say in defense of that line? What would you say to the argument that has been made many times by people who are pro-choice and pro-life that the line really doesn't make any sense, that it is, as Justice Blackmun himself described it, arbitrary? The woman's, if a woman wants to be free of the burdens of pregnancy, that interest does not disappear the moment the viability line is crossed. Isn't that right?
He's right. And that is never, it's always been a weakness in the argument of people the United States Solicitor General yesterday and Ms. Riggleman. There just isn't any coherence to viability. We've known that for a long time. Neil Gorsuch also points out stare decisis just can't save terrible law. Cut number 20.
May I ask you a question about stare decisis, counsel? Your colleagues on the other side have emphasized that Casey rejected Roe's trimester framework and replaced it with an undue burden standard. They argue that the undue burden standard was not well known to the law before that. And then they argue that the undue burden standard has evolved over time, too, in ways that the court has found difficult to agree upon. In Hellerstadt, for example, they point out in their briefs that the court seemed to suggest that a court should consider both the benefits and the burdens associated with the proposed restriction. In June Medical, more recently, the court splintered on that same question. Whether benefits could be considered or only burdens. And so the argument goes that this has proved to be putting aside all the other obviously difficult questions in the case, that the standard itself has proved difficult to administer and that is relevant to the stare decisis analysis. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond.
It absolutely is relevant. It means that stare decisis doesn't have any particular weight when you can't apply a precedent with reliability. At this point, I also want to play Justice Kavanaugh making an argument that is philosophical and I believe right. This is really 100% on target. Cut 23.
You make a very forceful argument and identify critically important interests that are at stake in this issue. No doubt about that. The other side says, though, that there are two interests at stake. That there's also the interest in fetal life at stake as well. And in your brief, you say that the existing framework accommodates, that's your word, both the interest of the pregnant woman and the interest of the fetus. And the problem, I think the other side would say, and the reason this issue's hard, is that you can't accommodate both interests. You have to pick. That's the fundamental problem. And one interest has to prevail over the other at any given point in time. And that's why this is so challenging, I think. And the question then becomes, what does the Constitution say about that? And I just want to get your reaction to what the other side's theme is, and I've mentioned it in my prior questions. When you have those two interests at stake, and both are important, as you acknowledge, why not? Why should this court be the arbiter rather than Congress, the state legislatures, state Supreme Courts, the people being able to resolve this. And there'll be different answers in Mississippi and New York, different answers in Alabama than California, because there are two different interests at stake. And the people in those states might value those interests somewhat differently. Why is that not the right answer?
It is the right answer, and Justice Kavanaugh knows that, and the people in the back of the room, the media should know that. Justice Barrett also wants to make sure that people understand there are changed circumstances from the back alley days of 1973, where babies could not be abandoned legally. There are now safe haven laws everywhere. Cut number 26, Justice Barrett.
I have a follow-up to Justice Kagan's question about reliance. I'm just trying to nail down, and I asked Ms. Rickleman this question, too, but I'm not sure that I fully understand the government's position or Ms. Rickleman's position. So on pages 18 and 19 of your brief, you talk about reliance interests, and you quote some of the language from Casey about a woman's ability to participate in the social and economic life of the nation. And I mentioned the safe haven laws to Ms. Rickleman, and it seems to me I fully understand the reliance interest. They're the airy ones Justice Kagan was referring to, and then there are the more specific ones about a woman's access to abortion as a backup form of birth control in the event that contraception fails so that she need not bear the burdens of pregnancy. But what do you have to say to petitioner's argument that those reliance interests do not include the reliance interests of parenting and bringing a child into the world when maybe that's not the best thing for her family or her career?
Because those reliance interests have changed, because mothers, upon the birth of their baby, without penalty, can give that baby away completely. And that was not the case in 73, maybe not even in 92. Chief Justice Roberts also speaks to viability and reliance. Cut number 25.
General, following up on that, would that argument be true in terms of viability as well? In other words, your discussion of the reliance interests and the ability of women and men to control their lives in reliance on the right to an abortion, the argument would not be as strong, I think you'll have to concede, given what we're talking about, which is not a prohibition. It's a 15-week line. Is that right?
Is that right? Yes, it's right. Mississippi's law will be upheld. What I just did in this segment, I began with Justice Thomas, the senior member of the court. I went to the Chief Justice, who will assign the opinion, I suspect, to himself. Then I went to Justice Alito, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, Justice Barrett. All of the justices, six justices, telegraphed in their questions and commentary on responses from counsel that Roe and Casey are finished. And I believe the Chief Justice will assign himself the opinion. I do not know if it will be the controlling holding. That means the most sweeping holding supported by five justices. I don't know. I suspect it will be. But Roe and Casey are finished, if those questions are indicative of where the court is going.
Coming up, there's a state of emergency in New York based on a virus that has not reached New York and which is described by the discoverer of the virus as mild.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. With a new and relatively unknown variant of the coronavirus in South Africa, now it's in the United States, and spreading around the world, many people went into a bit of a panic, including me. I believe this is a very bad development. Despite South African doctors describing the symptoms of Omicron as mild, my belief, and the market shared apparently, is that the unknown knowns are pretty bad, and the unknown unknowns are terrible. It appears the variant is, yes, now here in the United States, first reported Wednesday in the already locked-down state of California. But even before Omicron touched down in the States, one blue state governor went into Armageddon mode. Here's Dennis Prager.
This is actually, I'm not kidding, had I read it in Babylon Bee, I would have cracked up. Let's see. Kathy Hochul even enacted a state of emergency in New York to respond to the Omicron variant, despite the U.S. not having confirmed a single case of the new variant. But she'll say it could come here. There's a state of emergency in New York based on a virus that has not reached New York and which is described by the discoverer of the virus as mild. Dr. Angelique Kutze told The Telegraph she first suspected a new variant of COVID-19 was spreading when her medical practice in Pretoria saw an influx of patients with, quote, symptoms that did not make immediate sense. Kutze, who also serves as the chairwoman of the South African Medical Association, explained those symptoms included intense fatigue and a high pulse rate in younger patients, but not the loss of smell or taste. The hallmark symptom, I'm reading from The Blaze, of COVID-19. Kutze has also explained of the new variant, quote, it represents mild disease with symptoms having sore muscles and tiredness for a day or two, not feeling well. So far, we have detected that those infected do not suffer loss of taste or smell. They might have a slight cough. There are no prominent symptoms of those infected. Some are currently being treated at home. According to The Telegraph, Kutze made clear in a briefing to other African medical organizations that, quote, her patients were all healthy, and her real concern was for older people and those with comorbidities. Well, that's true for any disease. So why what are we talking about? Why does the President of the United States address this issue? Why is there a state of emergency in New York State? Ah, because it's governed by a Democrat. And a Democrat female. So it's a combination of factors, because females are disproportionately on the left and are disproportionately of the belief, better safe than sorry. Better safe than sorry. That is what it is. What is the thinking of a Hochul in calling a state of emergency in New York State? I think it is to show New Yorkers and America how on top of things she is, how seriously she takes this stuff. Because you pay no price in this country for suppressing people's liberties. You don't. You pay no price. Newsom, there was a recall and nothing happened. That's the reason. It's all upside for her. If nothing happens with Omicron, which is likely the case, so look, I was there. I took care of New Yorkers. Is she going to lose one vote because of that? That's the point. People have stopped valuing liberty. Because, it depends in the name of what. There's always a name. In the Soviet Union, people lost liberty in the name of social justice, in the name of equity, which are the cornerstones of leftism. But in Germany, they lost it in the name of the fatherland. And in the West now, and in fact throughout the world, in the name of health. How many years have I been saying on this show? You listen to this show regularly, I think you'll understand a lot about life. And how many years have I been saying health uber alles? Right? Has that not been one of my code words or themes? Health above all. I got this phrase from Deutschland über alles. Germany is above all. And this is what it is. Health above all. It's the first time in medical history, modern medical history, that people have suppressed remedies for a disease. Everything has been vaccine. Nothing has been therapy. It's the first time in American history that doctors have been told what they can or cannot prescribe. It's not between you and your patient. It's between you and the CDC and the state. It's mind-blowing. And yet, no price is paid.
The 2022 Winter Olympics are scheduled to take place in Beijing, China. We are mere months away from the February kickoff of this international event. But should we be there? Should any country who values life and liberty partake? Should any corporation want to sponsor these games? Should NBC air them? I discussed the ramifications with Wisconsin Congressman Mike Gallagher. China is involved in a genocide. Yesterday, the Wall Street Journal released documents that the New York Times has been sitting on for, I think, 2 years, that prove in a secret speech to the Presidium that General Secretary Xi ordered this. It's like Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956. Should anyone be going near Beijing for the Olympics?
No, for a variety of reasons. One, as we've talked about multiple times, it will give a genocidal communist regime. And again, it's important to remind ourselves that this genocide is an official declaration, a determination that both the Trump administration, Mike Pompeo's State Department has made, as well as the Biden administration under Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's State Department has made. So this isn't just hawkish Republicans calling this a genocide. It's Democrats and Republicans, two successive administrations, as well as most major European parliaments have called this a genocide. We will be giving a propaganda victory to a genocidal communist regime. And the history of totalitarian regimes shows that they have in the past used events like the Olympics in order to enhance the power of the state. Point one. Point two, from a coronavirus perspective, if we are led to believe that we should be concerned about Omicron, given the fact that we know the Chinese Communist Party has not been forthcoming about their data, their numbers make absolutely no sense. If you dig into some of the areas where they're reporting numbers, how is it safe for our athletes to go to a country that has, from the start of the pandemic, deliberately obscured what we know about cases and what we know about the origin of the pandemic? And so I think it makes no sense to hold the Olympics in Beijing. And I am increasingly concerned about what General Secretary Xi will do after pocketing the propaganda win in Beijing. And shame on the New York Times if this is true, because the documents allegedly reveal Xi's personal involvement in the genocide in Xinjiang. And hats off to Senator Marco Rubio for getting this out into the public space and shining a light on it. At a minimum, the New York Times needs to release the approximately, I think, 86 pages that have been withheld. We need to know what's going on here. And if this is true, I think this puts a nail in the heart of whatever tiny shred of integrity the New York Times had left.
This is a genocide. It's like covering up the Holocaust, and the New York Times is now in the position of covering up the Holocaust that is underway in China. Coming up, the truth about the taking down of a United States president.
Secret meetings with the judges, suppression of evidence that would be helpful to the defense, lies and falsehoods about Nixon's own personal involvement, and it's all there in writing for people to see.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment.
I'm Alex Berenson. My new book, Pandemia, is the true story about the coronavirus the mainstream media has tried to keep from you. The facts I've put together about COVID aren't secrets or conspiracy theories. They're available in government documents and scientific studies. My only agenda in writing Pandemia is to give you the truth about the suppression of your personal freedoms and the cost of our hysteria over the coronavirus.
The new book is entitled Pandemia, How Coronavirus Hysteria Took Over Our Government, Rights, and Lives by bestselling author Alex Berenson. Pandemia, available at Amazon and wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For a generation, the name Richard Nixon represented dirty politics and deceit. Full disclosure, I worked with Nixon during his years in exile in San Clemente, California, after his resignation. And as recently as last month, I was proud to serve as president of the Nixon Foundation, and I remain a member of the board. So I'm keenly aware of how effective Hollywood was at portraying the former president in, let me just say, a less than flattering light. It is rare to hear a kind word about Richard Milhouse Nixon. In time, history strips the emotion of the moment and often reveals things altogether different from what we thought, we heard, or knew in the past. Author Jeff Shepard has the rare opportunity to dig through previously unseen documents and now reveals the truth behind the efforts to take down the 37th President of the United States. His book is titled The Nixon Conspiracy. He is the foremost authority on Watergate in the land. He joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Tell people the three biggest takeaways in the Nixon conspiracy.
Absolutely. The first biggest takeaway is I got the roadmap unsealed. The roadmap was the secret report prosecutors sent to the grand jurors and then to the Hill accusing Nixon of personal crimes that they felt should have led to his impeachment. I got that unsealed, and when you look at it, it's filled with falsehoods and misrepresentations. The second takeaway from my book, The Nixon Conspiracy, is that I uncovered in the past several years four caches of documents prepared by special prosecutors that they took with them when they left office. And this prevented any understanding of their corrupt approach, their misconduct when they pursued Nixon and his top aides. And the third thing, which is hugely important, is that having completed the book and documented all of this wrongdoing by the special prosecutors, by a vengeful judge, and by a complacent media, I filed a complaint of attorney misconduct with the Department of Justice. It turns out they have an internal affairs unit that's sole responsibility is to investigate misconduct by Department of Justice attorneys, and I've called them on it. I've got the proof. All of my work is backed up by documents that are publicly available at the National Archives. It's astonishing what these folks committed to writing. Secret meetings with the judges, suppression of evidence that would be helpful to the defense, lies and falsehoods about Nixon's own personal involvement, and it's all there in writing for people to see. It's important to know what happened then, 50 years ago, because the same blueprint is being followed today. Once you get political prosecutions, truth goes out the window, and the facts don't matter. It just becomes people repeating their own talking points. And people think, oh, this is new today, but it's not. It was done 50 years ago. It was successful. They voided President Nixon's reelection, and there was no talk radio, no podcast, no Fox News, no Newsmax around to show the other side. So
now
most Americans.
Jeff, the Nixon conspiracy is out. People need to get it. I think, by the way, it's wonderfully written. I'm not surprised because you and I did 8 hours of conversation about the Nixon Library, about the Watergate scandal at the Nixon Library. People can watch that, but they're better off reading this. Now my transition question. Why is what you discovered, in a legal sense, material?
According to our Constitution, people under the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, people have a right to due process, which roughly translates as a right to fair trials. And it turns out, based on these documents that I've uncovered, the Watergate people, there were 24 members of Nixon's administration. They didn't get anything close to a fair trial. They had corrupt prosecutors, specially recruited, highly partisan prosecutors. They had a vindictive trial judge. And they had complacent media that was basically repeating falsehoods about them. Nixon had the same situation, but it had to do with the grand jury naming him a co-conspirator and evidence secretly sent up to the Hill by the special prosecutors, which was never made public. We didn't know what they had accused Nixon of doing until I got a court to unseal that roadmap. In 2018, until I was successful in that, we didn't know what they had accused Nixon of doing, and it turns out they couldn't prove it. In order
That is a definition of materiality right there. It changes the way people understand Watergate. It would have changed the way people defended themselves against criminal charges. It's material information. You know materiality, Jeff Shepard. You know what
That's
matters.
Correct.
You do.
Yes.
And
yes, I do.
Coming up, Democrat-run states seek to cap self-defense.
The interesting thing to me about the stand your ground laws is that they're most frequently used by minorities.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Grounded in our distinctive Great Books curriculum, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy prepares students for exciting careers in politics who understand the relevance of America's founding principles to today's policy challenges. From our Southern California campus, we've sent over 1,000 alumni across America and around the world. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun. Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Kyle Rittenhouse may have been unanimously acquitted by a jury of his peers, but progressives will try him day in and day out forever. Bitterness is a quality they value far above forgiveness. In fact, all legal gun owners are targets now, to one degree or another, of the left. John Lott authored the Regnery book, The War on Guns. He discussed Rittenhouse and other gun owners while on with Dan Proft and A.B. Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer out of Chicago.
So one of the topics coming out of the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and his acquittal is certainly about guns and, you know, the age and the rifle and the usual things. But it's also interesting that the left feels emboldened to talk about how we need to rethink self-defense laws.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing to me about the Stand Your Ground laws is that they're most frequently used by minorities who live in poor, high-crime areas, because they're the ones who are most likely victims of violent crime. You know, as with so many different types of actions the Democrats take with regard to guns, they end up doing things that make it more difficult for the people who actually benefit the most from having the option to be able to go and defend themselves to be able to go and do so. The things that they do to make it more costly, more difficult. I mean, in Illinois, the state that claims that it cares about minorities, because you have Democrats running everything, it costs $400 to go through the process to get a concealed handgun permit. You compare Illinois to Indiana. Illinois only has about 4% of the adult population with a concealed handgun permit. Neighboring Indiana has over 21% with it. And there's a simple reason for that. In Illinois, it's very costly to get it. In Indiana, it's $12.95 to be able to go and get a permit. Up until very recently, Chicago made it so that there wasn't even a training facility in the city. They banned it on public transportation, even if you had a permit. So if you're a poor black who lives in Chicago, even if you could afford the $400, if you didn't have a car, you'd have to go and borrow a car on multiple days, either 2 or 4 days, to travel way outside the city in order to get the training necessary for the 16 hours to get the permit. And you look at who gets permits in those places. In Illinois, it's primarily wealthy white who live in the suburbs. In Indiana, you see many more permits given to people who live in zip codes, which are relatively poor and are minority.
Speaking of Chicago and crime, Chicago has more people shot this year than they did last year. I mean, we were up north of 50% of both shootings and murders last year. Philadelphia just set a record. With its 501st murder, that's a record that dates back to 1990 in Philadelphia. And the interesting thing that they have in common, a lot of things in common, Democrat, socialist dominated, but also the prosecutors, Larry Krasner and Kim Fox, right, are cut from the same cloth. They're two Soros-funded non-prosecution prosecutors.
Exactly. I mean, it's not rocket science that we're talking about here. When you have an arrest rate for murders in Chicago that's like 20%, when you have even the one, and that's on average, gang murders are solved at a lower rate than on average. So a gang murder is even less likely than that to be arrested. And then you have the DA there refusing to prosecute many people. You just had a case, I guess it was about a month ago, where you had two rival drug gangs fighting it out in daylight, caught on video there, high-definition video. You had police witnessing it. You had one person killed and three people wounded. And the district attorney refused to file charges against the perpetrators there. First of all, I mean, one statement from the district attorney's office there was that, well, it was mutually agreed to combat.
We have that here.
Yeah, right.
Mutual combatants. I mean, it's crazy. Yeah. There was a video of a kid from Schaumburg killing a kid from Palatine, and Kim Fox didn't prosecute him because, like, no, they agreed to have a fight.
Well, it's we handle it in Chicago, a place like Philadelphia. Like, it's like sport. It's like the Coliseum. That's how we do crime control here.
You know, people want to go and blame it on lots of other things, but to me it's very simple, that if you make it so it's not risky for criminals to go and commit crime, they're going to commit a lot more crime. You know, you have to get rid of a lot of the politically correct restrictions you have on policing there. You know, the forms and other things that police have to spend their time filling out whenever they go and talk to people is just crazy. I mean, that's a rule, for example, that Rahm Emanuel had put in place
right.
when he made an agreement with the ACLU. And this last year, they cut like 400 positions from the police department. At the same time, I guess they spent millions of dollars protecting Lori Lightfoot and stuff. It's just crazy things that are going on. And the thing is, Democrats claim that they care about poor, that they care about minorities. But who do they think are overwhelmingly the victims of these crimes that are occurring, that they're not deterring? You know, and it's not just the direct victims there. The businesses, of course, now you're having even businesses in very nice areas in Chicago being destroyed. But, you know, who do they think primarily works in those areas? Who owns a lot of those companies? Who owns houses and property in those areas that are being reduced in value because of the crime? It's overwhelmingly poor minorities that are being harmed.
Support for gun control dropping overall, but it's up among those Democrat socialists, so they're incorrigible.
Yeah, we've seen several polls that have come out recently by Gallup, Quinnipiac, Rasmussen, and they all show a similar pattern. Gallup and Quinnipiac show about a 15 percentage point drop in support for gun control over the last 5 years, driven primarily by independents moving against stricter gun control. You know, you'd think that Democrats might rethink their position, but support among Democrats has soared. 91% of Democrats in both the Gallup and the Quinnipiac poll support even stricter gun control laws. In the Quinnipiac poll, by contrast, only 13% of Republicans support stricter gun control. Those are the largest partisan gaps on the issue.
Coming up, the Salvation Army controversy.
My kid is out there ringing a bell at the Red Kettle. He said, it's all we're hearing about.
The final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt when we return.
Hi, I'm Georgine Rice. This week in the Christian Outlook, sponsored by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. This week, the Supreme Court hears the most significant abortion case since Roe versus Wade.
There is no reason to consider this case unless Roe itself is at stake.
Lutheran pastors in Finland are facing a trial for adhering to a biblical stance on Christian morality.
It is impossible for me to think that the classical Christian views and the doctrine of the majority of denominations would become illegal.
And Baronelle Stutzman, the Seattle area florist, ends her battle in the courts.
I don't have the freedom to step away because I'm going to continue to fight for our freedoms, our religious freedoms, our Constitution.
Be sure to join us and visit our website at ChristianOutlook.com.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. The Salvation Army has long been known for their good works. The Bell and Red Kettle is a Christmastime staple, and the funds help the poor across the globe. And while they describe their mission as to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to meet human needs in his name, they recently ran into some trouble with a bit of woke ideology on racism. But after a public outcry, the international part of the Salvation Army retracted the guide that had done so much damage to the United States branch of the Salvation Army. Salem host Mike Gallagher explains.
Your voice matters. The outrage, the pushback, The Salvation Army has withdrawn its controversial Let's Talk About Racism guide. There was donor backlash, and other charities, frankly, benefited from the controversy. My son is part of Salvation Army's community. I'm proud of the work he does. I appreciate the work the Salvation Army does. But the organization attempted to be woke with a guide that asked white supporters of Salvation Army to deliver sincere apologies for their race and the past sins of Christians. The backlash has been unbelievable. My kid is out there ringing a bell at the Red Kettle. He said, it's all we're hearing about. The organization has opted to withdraw, as a result of the controversy, rather, the organization has opted to withdraw the guide for, quote, appropriate review. And I've gone through this. I saw what it's all about. Racism is incompatible with Christianity. It's ridiculous. Stay out of this woke race stuff. Let's raise money for people, for needy, deserving people. But yet organizations feel they got to go down this path. Organizations think they got, and as I understand it, these are a few higher ups at the Salvation Army who somehow thought it would be prudent to do this. Well, the backlash has been enormous, and I'm glad they've withdrawn the booklet. I'm glad they've withdrawn the guide. I'm glad that they are going to at least review it, and they ought to take it down. But this is what I mean about, and you know what you did in a positive way? You took a negative story like this, and you turned it into something very positive. Thousands of dollars poured in to our Angel Tree campaign, which is in no way affiliated with the Salvation Army. This is the Prison Fellowship Ministry. I've been getting hundreds of emails saying, Mike, are you fundraising again for this? I'm not. I don't fundraise for the Salvation Army. We support the Prison Fellowship Ministry, which sends Christmas gifts to the children of prisoners in America. No affiliation whatsoever for the Salvation Army. So you take a story like this and you say, you know what? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put my support behind this organization that Mike is supporting, Prison Fellowship Ministry.
Thank you for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Pouchon, Michael Cook, Ben Brigman, Alex Perez, Adam Ramsey, and of course, Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.